CITR 101.9 FM presents News 101, Vancouver's volunteer-produced student and community newscast.
Now here's your host, Brad Pepping.
Good evening. On the program today in local news, we'll bring you highlights from the Michael Ignatieff Town Hall that took place earlier today in the Student Union Building. In provincial news, we'll address the implementation of a fleet of hydrogen buses in Whistler that will coincide with the start of the Winter Games next month. Later in the show, we'll hear from Roger Annis from Haiti Solidarity BC about the ongoing relief effort in Haiti following the devastating earthquake earlier this week. We'll have all this plus arts and your weekend weather forecast coming up this hour right here on News 101. As part of his cross-country tour, opposition leader Michael Ignatieff spoke today to UBC students, staff, and the community at a town hall meeting. Calling it his most attended town hall on the tour, Mr. Ignatieff addressed a packed theater of almost 1,200 interested participants, briefly speaking and answering students' questions. Reporter Andrew Longhurst was at the town hall and prepared the following special report for News 101. Early in his speech, Ignatieff spoke about the problematic trend of a decrease in young voter turnout and an overall increase in apathy.
I'm proud to be a politician. I'm proud to put it all on the line for my party and for my country and for what I believe. And there's some politicians in the room, and they're proud to be political figures. But many of you, many of your generation is deeply skeptical about politics, deeply disillusioned with politics, cynical about politics. And one of the things I wanted to say about that cynicism is that it is producing a social change that we should think about hard as a country. At the last federal election, of the 18-year-olds who were eligible to vote for the first time, only 1 in 5 showed up.
Mr. Ignatieff later condemned the Prime Minister's prorogation of Parliament. He told the packed theater that the Prime Minister had bet wrong on suspending the workings of Parliament. He claimed that today's incredible turnout at the town hall was a testament to Canada's anger over the decision.
On New Year's Eve, the Prime Minister of this country picked up the phone and phoned the Governor General and canceled Parliament, prorogued Parliament. What was interesting about that is that the Prime Minister thought you didn't care. It didn't matter to you whether Parliament sat or didn't sat. What was interesting is that he gambled on your cynicism. He gambled on your disillusion. He gambled on your sense that Parliament doesn't matter. He gambled on your impatience and withdrawal from politics. And interestingly, he gambled wrong. 185,000 people signed up to the Facebook site condemning the prorogation of Parliament. He must have thought nobody knew what prorogation was, and suddenly, everywhere I go, people are experts on prorogation, right? It's a very interesting little phenomenon in Canada. So he gambled that you didn't care, and he gambled wrong. And when I started this tour, to be frank, I didn't think anybody'd show up, and you've shown up in incredible numbers. So that's a very interesting and hopeful sign. But we need to stand against a politics that exploits your cynicism. You've got a responsibility and I've got a responsibility. Your responsibility is it's your darn country. If you don't show up, if you don't join a political party, if you don't bother to vote, they certainly will. And you won't like the country you get. It's that simple.
Opposition leader Michael Ignatieff later spoke about the importance of energy efficiency in Canada. He commented that it is no longer a choice and that energy efficiency is a necessity. However, Ignatieff did not offer any solutions or legislations he plans to introduce.
We're going to have oil at $1, $1.50, maybe $2. Absolute constraints on the supply of energy. So energy is going to be expensive. That means we're going to have to drive energy efficiency, drive it and drive it and drive it. The countries that use energy most efficiently are the countries that then win.
Mr. Ignatieff briefly highlighted his three priorities for Canada. These included making Canada the best educated country in the world, the greenest, and the most international.
When you come out into the workforce, right behind you will be the biggest retirement generation in the history of the world, the baby boom generation. They will put pressure on healthcare costs. They will put pressure on senior care, pressure on home care. This whole economy will have to sustain a huge and rising burden of social care. And if we don't have a productive, effective, efficient economy, we can't sustain the compassion, the conscience, the sticking together that's marked us as a people. And it falls on your generation, an ever smaller generation bearing the burden of caring for an ever larger group of elderly Canadians, right? So that's what you're looking at, and that's what we have to start thinking about and having a national conversation about. When I look at that, I haven't got the solution to every problem, but I know there are three things that come out of this that seem to me essential. In 2017, we have to be the best educated society on the planet. We have to invest and invest and invest in places like the one we're lucky to be in tonight. That's number one, the best educated society in the world. The second obvious implication of what I've been saying is we have to be the most energy efficient society on the planet, namely the greenest society on the planet, right? That's number two. But the third one you might not have thought about and seems to me to be equally important. We have to be the most international society in the world, the most curious, the most outwardly turned. We have to be the master of the languages of the world.
In the second half of the town hall, Mr. Ignatieff fielded questions from the audience. One student asked if he will sign the Kyoto Plus petition. After continuing to evade the question, the student angrily shouted, "Will you sign it?" There was palpable frustration in the room.
Hi. First of all, I'd like to thank you for coming today. Like many other people in this room...
I want to thank you for coming today.
Yes, like many other students in this room and a growing number of the population, climate change is on the forefront of my mind and I feel is the most important issue of our time. You've said that in line with the science, we need to cut our emissions in Canada at least 80% below 1990 levels by the year 2050. These are the same targets as outlined in Kyoto Plus, something you are yet to sign. In order to believe that the Liberals will lead Canada to achieving these emission reduction targets, Canadians need to see a firm commitment made, one which includes developing strong short-term targets as well as a plan on how to achieve them. By signing Kyoto Plus, you would be making the firm commitment that Canadians need to see in order to take your words seriously. Many of your Liberal colleagues have already signed on to Kyoto Plus. Why haven't you signed on to this commitment, and are you willing to sign on to Kyoto Plus today?
Thank you. Our party has a very firm and clear commitment that we need to keep global temperature from, do our part, Canada's part, to keep global temperature rising more than 2 degrees Celsius. We need to have a cap and trade system immediately. We've got to stop waiting for the United States to define Canadian climate change policy. And that's a key point here. This is an issue of Canadian sovereignty. We don't talk enough about the extent to which climate change policy is an issue of national sovereignty. Hang on. If you ask me a question, wait for the answer. You get an answer. I'm here to give you an answer. My sense is that I'm not going to let a Kyoto Plus petition be the test of whether I've got a credible climate change policy. I think this movement has had an enormously productive effect on public opinion. But I'm a public official. My responsibility is to create a credible climate change policy for a party in opposition that hopes to be in government. And that's what I plan to do. That's what I'm saying. We need to have a cap-and-trade system. We need to get it started now. We need to stop waiting for the United States. We need to stop waiting for Barack Obama and Waxman Markey to give us our climate change policy. We need to develop it in Canada. The three provinces have already started with some cap-and-trade activity. We need federal leadership. We need to make the tar sands a sustainable industry. We need to get its water use down. We need to have protection of our boreal forest. We need to have protection of marine-sensitive areas. I have a very, very broad vision of what Canada needs to meet the environmental challenge. The Conservatives have not met any of these challenges, and I propose to do so. So that's the answer I'm going to give to the question. Thank you. Let's go to the next one.
After fielding the question about Canada's foreign aid, Mr. Ignatieff discussed his displeasure with the Canadian International Development Agency. He believes that Canadian NGOs should be the ones primarily responsible for administering foreign development.
We have been following the discussion across the country, particularly in regards to foreign aid. You mentioned that CETA is too bureaucratic and that Canada's foreign aid needs to focus on poverty reduction. What are you doing now and plan to do in the future to make sure Canada's aid is more effective? Thank you.
Thank you. One of the most heartening things, I mean, a 10-city tour of campuses is a learning experience for me. One of the things I've learned is how important international development issues are to your generation, and that is terrific. What I've said elsewhere, and I repeat here, is that we've got a CETA, an international development organization, that is too bureaucratic. 80% of its people are in Ottawa as opposed to in the field. We ought to reverse that. 20% in Ottawa, 80% in the field, number one. Number two, one of the ways to make it less bureaucratic is make our international development assistance work better with the Canadian NGOs who do such a terrific job. Many of you belong to, you know, Engineers Without Borders, Reporters Without Borders, various outfits without borders. What you need, yeah, tear those borders down, you know. Yes. What you need is a federal government nimble enough, quick enough to partner with you to deliver aid.
Thank you to Andrew Longhurst for bringing us that report. It's now time for a break, but stay tuned for more national and provincial news. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
LiveVan.com is Vancouver's most reputable community-driven concert calendar. New shows are listed daily by the city's most prominent promoters, but also by you. The musicians and fans who are the driving force of our local music scene. LiveVan.com's listings are different because they're personalized. They're integrated with local music directories that are constantly updated by the bands, musicians, and businesses who refer to them as they pick locations and lineups for their newest upcoming shows. And no one's barred from contributing, since we all know fans know more about the players than anyone. So visit livemusicvancouver.com for the latest major and independent event listings. And while you're at it, check out our archives and discover how closely we all work together in this community, putting on the shows you love.
Welcome back. You're listening to News 101, broadcasting live from the Student Union Building at UBC. Thanks for being with us tonight. In provincial news, the Olympics are coming around the bend, and our eyes are turning to the impact of the expected 2 million tourists that will soon descend upon British Columbia. While many are concerned about the sheer excess of garbage expected to be produced by these millions, Maclean's magazine citing an additional 2.2 million kilos of waste produced by tourists alone during the Games, environmentalists are addressing the transportation crisis in British Columbia. In Whistler, BC Transit has begun preparation for the unveiling of a fleet of hydrogen buses. But while many hail the move as a triumphant example of reducing our provincial carbon footprint, many remain skeptical. Ian Bruce from the David Suzuki Foundation told the CBC earlier this week that he believes BC Transit's actions to be nothing more than window dressing. Addressing what he described as a project that must be financially viable, Ian Bruce questioned the merits of deploying a fleet of hydrogen buses when the hydrogen that will fuel them is being transported from Quebec. Earlier this week, reporter Megan Turcato spoke with Joanna Morton of BC Transit about the fleet and the allegation of the province window dressing in preparation of the Olympic Games.
So first of all, just to give our listeners some background on the hydrogen buses, Premier Gordon Campbell announced these in 2007 and that the province would contribute $44.5 million to deploy this fleet of hydrogen buses in Whistler and Victoria, with a further $45 million coming from the federal government.
Mm-hmm. I would probably want to say that specifically Whistler. Mm-hmm. This fleet will just be operating in Whistler, not in Victoria.
Okay. So can you describe why it was a decision to just deploy hydrogen buses when they will cost four times more than regular diesel-powered buses to deploy?
Sure. Well, looking at the Whistler community, their culture, their values, really what we're looking at is a number of ways to improve transit within the community. And what they really wanted was to find an alternative fuel source, something that would be cleaner, greener, and really speak to Whistler's values.
So was this decision meant to intentionally coincide with the Olympics, the deployment of the buses?
No, it's not. However, I would like to point out that given the fact that the 2010 Winter Games are going to be in Whistler, it really gives us an opportunity to showcase our fleet, number one, and also to demonstrate this new technology right here on our grounds.
Can you comment on what degree of increased transportation use is expected in Whistler for the Games?
Oh, definitely. Really, for the most part, if we were to look at the transit system right now in Whistler, we've got 28 buses. And so BC Transit will be providing enhanced service, not just in the town of Whistler, but for Pemberton and Squamish as well, and also providing increased connecting services between the three communities.
So why did you choose to implement the hydrogen buses in Whistler over somewhere like Vancouver? And is there any plans to expand this program?
Sure. Just to give you some background, so BC Transit has 81 systems all across the province, and the Lower Mainland itself, the authority for that is TransLink.
Okay. So yeah. It was really not your jurisdiction? Is that
no.
The idea? Okay. So there has been some controversy over how green the hydrogen buses are, with the David Suzuki Foundation calling them simply window dressing. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, I would say that really this is cutting-edge technology. It's no greenhouse gas emissions. So if you were to look at what comes out of the tailpipe, it's just air and water.
Mm-hmm. But there is concern that the hydrogen is being transported all the way from Quebec because it's not available in British Columbia, and the transportation of the hydrogen itself is causing the release of gas, greenhouse gases.
Mm-hmm. And if we were to factor that in, so if we're talking from wheel to well, is what they call, mm-hmm. We can still see a reduction of 62% in greenhouse gas emissions. Now, we've just recently announced that there is going to be a local fuel supplier come 2011. So by having a local fuel supplier from North Van tracking it up to Whistler, we'll see even greater reductions in greenhouse gas emissions.
Is there any hope that more hydrogen production will come online in British Columbia, or is this not something that's on the horizon?
Well, really, I think that's what this whole test is all about. BC Transit is operating this as a demonstration fleet. Nowhere in the world has there ever been a fleet of this size. A lot of communities out there have tested probably like one or two hydrogen buses, but never in a fleet configuration. By being able to test out 20 hydrogen fuel cell buses, forming the backbone of the Whistler Transit system, we'll really be able to assess if this is a viable fuel alternative for our buses.
And how long will the hydrogen bus pilot project continue for?
This will be running until 2014.
And what kind of, how will you measure whether or not this has been a success? The pilot project.
Oh, sure. Well, we'll be just testing the operational viability, maintenance, the cost of running the system, and, customer convenience and their thoughts on it as well.
Okay. Is there anything else you want people to know about this new program?
Let's see. Well, I heard that one comment about how we can actually call them green, but really at the end of the day, if we were to look at buses themselves, it's really a greener alternative, right?
Mm-hmm.
A fully loaded bus could potentially take 40 cars off of the road, therefore reducing greenhouse gas emissions.
So yes, it's not meant to be, no one's claiming it's an elimination, but it is an improvement, and that's something we should be moving towards.
Oh, definitely. And, if we're going to be forward-thinking, being progressive, and looking at ways to reduce our carbon footprint, not only do we need to improve, expand transit service across the province, but we also need to explore green and clean technology. BC Transit has a long history of actually testing new technologies, such as, introducing low-floor buses, using hybrid buses, including biodiesel within its fleet. And so we've done a number of things from the green perspective, and hydrogen fuel cell technology is just one of them.
Is there any other green initiatives that we can look towards that are coming up?
Good question. I think that BC Transit is going to be focusing on this fleet right now.
Today, I also spoke with Matt Horan of the Pembina Institute about what needs to be done in order to address BC's carbon footprint. Here's what he had to say about sustainability in transportation.
Certainly transportation is going to be a big element of overall sustainability solutions. And with some of the investments that are happening around Whistler in terms of fuel cell buses, different technology solutions are going to be part of it. I think when it comes down to it, the big key to making progress on transportation and transit issues in particular is finding ways to increase levels of investment in transit so that there are more options out there and transit is accessible to more people. I think it's appropriate to do some exploration of new technologies and testing them out because they ultimately will be a key part of us in the transit fleets of BC. But really where we're looking right now, the bulk of the investment should be happening in broadening the transit investment or transit opportunities that are available to British Columbians.
Thanks to BC Transit and the Pembina Institute for their comments. It's now time for a break, but stay tuned. Up next, we bring you an interview with Roger Annis of Haiti Solidarity Plus Arts and your weekend weather.
Remember when you first learned about the birds and the bees? Want to learn more about the birds and the bees and the berries, urban agriculture, delicious homegrown food, solar energy, and much more? Check out the Society Promoting Environmental Conservation. Come to one of our workshops, join our solar panel tour, or go to our website, www.spec.bc.ca, for more information.
This is News 101, and the current time is 5:26. Even just at the start of 2010, the world is again on bated breath as Haiti hangs in the precipice of further devastation in the wake of this week's tremendous earthquake. Earlier today, reporter Megan Turcato spoke with Roger Annis of Haiti Solidarity BC. Here's what he had to say.
So first of all, can you describe what you're hearing about the situation in Haiti right now?
Well, we have a very grave concern that the emergency relief that's been committed and that is beginning to arrive there, get into the city as quickly as possible. Of course, this is going to be a huge, huge effort that's required. The roads are heavily damaged. It may not be possible to move a lot of food and water and medical personnel by road, I don't know, but certainly there's helicopters on hand and there needs to be lots more. So, we're very concerned that that the rescue effort that's arriving there get dispersed into the city as quickly as possible. We also heard a disturbing report yesterday from BBC from the city of Jacmel, which is 50 miles or so south of Port-au-Prince on the south coast of the country. It was hit almost as hard as Port-au-Prince. I saw the aerial view. Most buildings in the city seemed to be down. And according to the BBC report, there was nothing that had been arrived yet in Jacmel. So, of course, we've now passed the 48-hour time in which people trapped in rubble and so forth are become extremely vulnerable. But now basic needs around water, food, and, of course, emergency medical care become the more important hour after hour. So we can only sit here and hope and expect that the most rapid emergency aid will get to the affected areas. Some of our initial reports being received today are a little bit disturbing in that regard.
How do you feel about Canadian aid in particular in terms of the pledge to match funds donated by Canadians and the suggestion that of fast-tracking immigration from Haiti?
Well, for the aid, the outpouring from Canadians has been terrific and very, very, very moving. Canadians feel concern and solidarity with the Haitian people at this time. And certainly the government's decision to match dollars that Canadians contribute to registered organizations that are delivering relief in Haiti is welcome, and maybe more is going to be required as we go forward in the days ahead. Yes, there's been the beginning of discussion about Canada welcoming the refugees from the earthquake into the country, and this should happen as speedily as possible, and we can only hope that that will be taken seriously, because it's been a very contentious issue in the United States, where the government has put up all kinds of barriers to the ability of Haitian people to immigrate to the United States, be it to join family or for other reasons. So we certainly think that's going to have to be a major part of the rescue effort of the after the earthquake, because the city of Port-au-Prince is not fit for human habitation for the most part. One written report that I've seen is basically every second multi-story building in the city has collapsed. So it's not habitable, and the world is going to have to do something pretty seriously and pretty quickly to save the lives of those that have survived the earthquake.
So in the past, your organization has expressed some concerns over the way international aid has been delivered to Haiti. Are there any hidden side effects of things like the influx of foreign soldiers into Haiti that we're now seeing that we should watch out for?
Well, the Canada-Haiti Action Network has been very critical of the policies of Canada, the United States. France is another big player in Haiti, and then since the overthrow of Haiti's elected president in 2004, Brazil has become a major player. It's the largest military component of the UN operation. We consider the overthrow of Haiti's elected government in 2004 to be a criminal act, illegal, unconstitutional. It's something that has shattered the social infrastructure of Haiti. It's affected the country at all levels, economically, in the education of children and health care. Under President Aristide, this was a country that was making progress, and that was cut short because he defied the notion that Haiti should just be a reserve of cheap labor and cheap resources. And so now, 6 years later, following that event, we have another natural disaster that struck Haiti. Of course, nothing could have prevented the earthquake, but the complete and total absence of emergency infrastructure in the country is just another consequence of the years and decades of foreign interference, foreign intervention.
But to get back to the question, is there concerns you have about the aid that is being delivered now or the way it's being delivered?
Yeah, there's huge concerns to see that this aid operation, become a military operation. Now, in the immediate sense, of course, the way the world runs, it's the militaries that are the best equipped to take on this kind of task. At least in Canada and the United States, it's probably not true in a place like Cuba, where there's a vast civil emergency system in place, and that's certainly coming into play for Haiti today. But sure, there's a great concern in the longer run. There's thousands of additional soldiers now that are in Haiti, a large contingent from from the United States and the track record of foreign military presence on Haitian soil, and including in the past 6 years, is a very negative one.
And so there are presidential and legislative elections scheduled for this February. Given this devastating earthquake, what do you see the future for the, I guess, political situation in Haiti?
Well, those elections will now be canceled, of course. It won't be possible to hold them. And in fact, in the haste in which they were called, and they were to be held on February 28th, in the haste that they were called, it was not really going to be possible to have a democratic election, above all because the election authority in Haiti, operating with the backing and support of the United Nations mission in Haiti, had banned Haiti's largest political party from participating in the election. That's the Fanmi-Lavalas party of Jean-Bertrand Aristide. So, you know, moving beyond the immediate emergency aid relief, and then looking at, you know, the months and years down the road that it's going to take to rebuild what's been shattered by the earthquake. Under the present political circumstances, we can have little confidence that that will take place. There needs to be a considerable political pressure brought to bear on the big powers of the world that have the means to help Haiti rebuild, that they do so, and they have to do so in a way that's respectful of Haiti's political sovereignty, that's respectful of the electoral choices of the Haitian people. And what we've had over the past 25 years is anything but that.
So when you're talking about the coup in 2004, there are differing points of view on this, and some people see Aristide as being his election in 2000 as having irregularities itself, and that there were gangs loyal to Aristide that were responsible for a lot of violence at that time, and that's what caused his overthrow. How would you respond to...
Well, I'd say in general that this is the version in Haiti of the weapons of mass destruction story that we were told in Iraq. The accusations against President Aristide in particular, and his government more generally, that following his second election in the year 2000 were simply false. There was nothing whatsoever on the scale of human rights violations that were made against President Aristide and his government. Was his government perfect? No. But it was a government that was determined to alleviate the lot of the poorest people in Haiti. And this is what brought down upon him the big powers of the world and the Haitian elite. The fact is that there was such a propaganda drive made against President Aristide that, you know, this interpretation of events between 2000 and 2004 has gained a lot of credence. And unfortunately, a lot of non-governmental organizations in Canada were partly responsible for perpetrating that myth. The human rights violations that came into play in Haiti following President Aristide's overthrow were 100 and 1,000 times graver than anything that would have taken place during his rule. And for the most part, the international media and many of the, you know, so-called human rights organizations were either silent or they were just very episodic in their reporting on this.
Given all this history of problems, what do you see as the UN's involvement in Haiti? Can it be turned around, or is there something else that needs to be done in order to improve the situation?
The UN and the United States and Canada and Europe have a considerable debt that is owed to Haiti and a considerable responsibility for it to develop economically and socially. That's not only our responsibility in a general human sense that any developed part of the world needs to have towards the poorer parts of the world, but in particular because of the constant intervention and interference that Haiti has faced. So what the United Nations should be doing today is taking measures to strengthen the capacity of the Haitian government itself to provide the kinds of services and leadership and direction in matters such as emergency relief, for example. That's where the resources of the United Nations should be going, and there should be an orderly withdrawal of the military and police contingent of the United Nations done together with the Haitian government. In fact, President Preval, who's, you know, not been particularly vocal or strong on this point, has nonetheless made the point numerous times that the amount of money that the UN is spending in Haiti on police and soldiers and jails and so forth is grossly out of proportion to what it should be spending. It should be building schools, building hospitals, repairing roads, facilitating investment into the country, building of a tourism industry, repairing Haiti's agriculture production, which has been so damaged by the trade policies of the United States. Yes, these are things that should be done, but you know, it's going to require such a sea change in politics in this part of the world for that to take place, and that begins, I think, by Canadians now becoming more aware of Haiti, putting aside the prejudices that they've learned, all of us have learned through school and media and the like, see Haiti for what it is, which is one of the most noble countries in the world. It's a tremendous, deeply rich history of struggle against slavery and then against colonialism. You know, take off the prejudice blinders and understand that it's a country that's been victimized by 200 years of colonialism, and let's get to work in helping them reshape the country, not by imposing models from the outside, but by respecting their sovereignty and recognizing their capacity to solve their problems if only they could get the big powers of the world off their backs.
So to bring this back to the earthquake in full circle, what can people do if they want to make sure their aid is getting, they feel moved by this, the pictures and such that they're seeing, and they want to make sure their aid is getting directly to Haitians?
Well, they can go to the medical organizations that are going to be providing so much important services in the coming weeks. Doctors Without Borders, I mentioned in particular Partners in Health, which is the largest healthcare deliverer in Haiti. On our website, CanadaHaitiAction.ca, we list a couple of other places where people can consider sending their money, and these are organizations, the Sawatsky Family Foundation and the Haiti Emergency Relief Fund, that are providing funds and materials directly to popular organizations in the affected area. And then beyond that, you know, people have to do their homework. Seek out the organizations that are working hand in glove with the Haitian people, and don't look for generalities in their reports. Look for the specifics of the schools they operate and how many children are there. And
okay, well, thanks for talking to me today.
Well, you're very welcome. Thank you for your interest.
That was Roger Annis of Haiti Solidarity BC with an update about the situation in Haiti following this week's earthquake. Thanks to Megan Turcato for that report. It's currently 5:40 in time for your weekend weather report, and here's Denise Dydick. And Denise, I couldn't help but notice it's sunny.
It is. Such a beautiful day came out of a dreary week. I hope everyone enjoyed the sunshine. Here's your weekend weather for January 15th through 17th. Tonight should be free from rain, clear and cloudy periods, with a low of 3 degrees. However, a low-pressure system should hit Vancouver by Saturday afternoon, bringing rain. High of 9 degrees, low of 5. Sunday will also bring showers, with a high of 9 degrees and a low of 4. So, unfortunately, it's nowhere near time to retire those umbrellas, but hopefully more snow will develop on the mountains. And now it's time for some more weather trivia. What is the highest wind speed ever recorded, and where? The answer will be revealed on next Friday's show. That's your weekend weather, brought to you by the Storm Club of UBC. For News 101, I'm Denise Diotic.
Thanks so much for that, Denise. It's exciting to hear about what's going on, and we look forward to that trivia. It's now time for your arts at News 101 here, and for that we turn to our trusty reporter, Megan Turcato. Megan, what's going on?
Well, last night I took in the opening of the new musical Debt at the Fire Hall Theatre. So written right into its premise is the tension between the frivolity of musical theatre and the unyielding modern financial system. The play was less about debt and more about the various ways we relate to money. So it had a lot of material to work with. It had the potential to be a riotously, if somewhat dark, comedy which shrewdly examines the faults of our precarious economic system. However, I felt that the play fell somewhat flat, with stereotypical starving artists, single moms, and wealthy socialites living beyond their means, making up the majority of the characters. I felt like the play would have had more substance if it had probed deeper into questions such as why we feel the need to consume beyond our means in the first place. Additionally, the cast could not deliver the exuberance required of musical theater. On several occasions, actors flubbed their lines, and let's just say the singing wasn't top quality. That said, the play did have some redeeming features. Singing skills aside, there were many memorable songs with the entire cast. For example, the entire cast dressed up as credit cards and called on the ill-fated characters to use them. To purchase more products, that is. Another highlight was the song Go Postal. This Caribbean-inspired song tested the characters on the probability of them going on violent workplace outbursts. Another highlight of the play was that it was firmly grounded in Vancouver. One song, Basement Dwellers, was even a homage to the ubiquitous basement suite. The addition of the live band on stage was also a nice touch. Debt is playing at the Fire Hall Theatre until January 30th. For more arts, catch the Arts Report with Tracy Fuller, Wednesdays at 5 p.m. on CITR. Back to you, Brad.
Thanks so much for that, Megan. Very interesting. And that's our program for January 15th, 2010. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, give us a hot news tip, or get involved with the show, contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334, or you can email news@citr.ca. Andrew Longhurst produced this radio program. For more news, join us Monday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Brad Pepink. From the entire news team at CITR, thanks for listening. And stay tuned for play-by-play sports right here on 101.9 FM CITR.